Day2 Cloud sponsor Onyx is a premier Google Cloud partner and an AWS advanced consulting partner. They're also an 11-time Google Cloud Award winner and was recently recognized as Tech Times number one for best cloud consulting services in 2020. For a limited time, Onyx is offering a free 6-hour cloud data strategy workshop. That's kind of a big deal. That's normally a $2,000 service. For more information and to find out more about the 6-hour cloud data strategy workshop, visit onyxnet.com/packetpushers.
Welcome to Day2 Cloud. The topic for today's episode is going to be, hey, AWS just lost their CEO. What's going to happen there? I mean, he isn't gone, but he's moving on and they need to replace that void with something else. Does it need to be another high-powered type person, an A-type personality, or could they just swap it out with a ham sandwich? And to answer that question, I'd like to bring onto the show two humans I mostly admire. We've got Ethan Banks and Drew Connery Murray from the Packet Pushers, both joining me to talk through this issue. So we're going to do that. Stay tuned after the episode. We are going to be also talking to ThousandEyes about remote VPN monitoring in a 15-minute Tech Byte extravaganza. So that will be after this segment. So let's get into it. Drew, you brought this topic to my attention at first. So why don't you lay out your thought process and overall thesis? I'm personally undecided. I have no idea what's going to happen.
Yeah, so I did bring it to you guys. So if this podcast goes sideways, it's entirely my fault and I apologize to the listeners. But there's a lot of hoopla around Andy Jassy's ascension from AWS to being CEO of the overall Amazon business. And of course, that means there's a succession question in AWS. And so my thought was, AWS seems like it's been set up pretty solidly and that pretty much, as you said, Ned, a ham sandwich could step into the CEO role and things would generally be fine. And now I'm here to prove that point, or at least try to prove it.
Ethan, are you thinking something along the same lines or do you have a contrary opinion to what Drew is positing?
Somewhat contrary. I think I understand that perspective from Drew, but my take is that AWS is in a situation where they stand to lose. They are in a market position of leadership for sure, right? Huge market share. They're the gorilla in public cloud. But if you look at what's been happening as enterprises especially have been adopting public cloud, I think they are losing customers. And despite their many billions of revenue each year, it's not just a ham sandwich can walk in and things are just going to continue on as they have been. The next 5 to 10 years for Amazon are going to require a leader that gets what enterprises are going through and can figure out clever ways to capture their revenue for the long haul.
So you're saying they need more of a ham sandwich with Brie. That would really insulate some pears. That would really level the playing field. Obviously, that's preposterous. I'm glad you have a contrary opinion. Otherwise, this would be a very boring episode of us just agreeing with each other. So, Drew, what do you think AWS has going for it now that could continue on regardless of who's sitting in the CEO chair?
First thing is AWS obviously had first mover advantage. They essentially created the IaaS market. They built the basic constructs, EC2, S3, Route 53, all those key elements to spin up and use compute in the cloud. We've seen competitors emerge, but AWS being the first mover gets them out in front, sort of helps them define the market, attract the first customers, and so on. They designed the company to be sticky in several key ways. First, they capture the developers, right? They make it easy for developers to write applications on the cloud. You don't even have to talk to a boss, just use a credit card. You've got a compute instance, bam, you're up and running. Once you start building an application in the cloud and data starts hitting that cloud, then the data gravity takes over. And that sort of turns into a perpetual motion machine where the more data you're putting into that cloud, the stickier the cloud becomes. And then it's just self-reinforcing for AWS.
Sort of. So my take on that is sort of, as in everything you said is exactly true, but... So one of the big buts, I couldn't have phrased that worse. Anyway, one of the big buts is that there are things that are showing up now in common IT speak that belie that that's everything that's going on. One of them is cloud repatriation. I put something in the cloud. It's so bloody expensive that I'm now taking it back out of the cloud and I'm going to host it either somewhere else or just bring it back in internally. Let's just focus on that for a minute. That being a thing, is due to the fact that enterprises are realizing the lift and shift approach isn't working out. If I take my workload and just basically replicate up in the cloud what I've been doing in my data center for the last decades, that doesn't work. It's not a cost-efficient spend. We know this. We've had this conversation, Ned, many times on Day 2 Cloud with different folks. The whole idea is don't think about picking up a workload and just dumping it in the cloud, save money. That doesn't work. Instead, you need to rethink about how that application is delivered, what that delivery system is, re-architect that application, and that's the hard part, re-architect that application to take advantage of cloud native, some combination of services that are up there in the cloud that allow you to deliver that application cost effectively. And if you do that, then public cloud can give you an economic win. Some might argue enterprises don't care how much they're spending, but I think a lot of them actually do, because the cost of running your workloads in the public cloud is a major topic of discussion. How to be more economical about it, how to be smart about it. We've had Corey Quinn on the show, and he's built a business out of that, helping companies optimize their cloud spends. So my take is, yes, it's easy today. Yes, it's developer friendly and so on. But the cost of doing it and doing it right means it's not as easy as swiping a credit card. It means having to re-architect your applications. And that's a tough thing and something that I feel New Jassy needs to get his or her head around.
Right. One of the themes of reInvent last year was really focused on actually reinventing your applications to run on the cloud. That was like the primary focus of everything they were doing, is saying just an acknowledgement that they can't lift and shift. Enterprises can't do that and expect magic to happen. They have to reinvent the way they do things. And oh, here's all our whiz bang services that allow you to reinvent yourself in the way you do things. I like the messaging. I'm not convinced enterprises can move in that sort of agile fashion a lot of the time. On the cost side of things, if you think about data centers and the sunk costs you already have in those, you don't see that on an annual basis or a monthly basis, let's say, but you do see your AWS bill come in on a monthly basis and go, whoa. And you probably haven't successfully shut down your data center, so now you're kind of like paying for both. Drew, do you think that they can just coast by on the messaging they already have out there, or do they have to get in front of that big truck that's coming through?
Well, I think we're in the stage where the cloud companies are working through that big truck, because cloud, I remember being originally positioned as low cost because, look, you can get this instance for essentially pennies or fractions of a pennies, and wow, okay, that's amazing. And I don't have to bear all the costs of running the hardware itself. That's a win for me. That's an ROI win for me. But then once you actually start using the services, that's where the bill shows up. So I think we've gotten past the notion that cloud is somehow cheaper, and we've worked through the disappointment of enterprises realizing that that's not the case. Ethan, to your point about cloud repatriation, that's not just an AWS problem. That's a problem for anybody who's providing cloud services. So Azure, Google, IBM, Oracle, whatever, they're going to face that same issue. The third point is that AWS's opportunity is now that enterprises have made the mistakes on, let's just try to duplicate what we do on-prem up in the cloud, is that AWS has rolled out the digital transformation roadmap, which every organization says they want. They're saying, here's the constructs you need, like a sort of a container and microservices architecture. Just spin up the services you need, find a way to connect them. Here's the path to go down. Here's the services we use to do that. Maybe someday you'll get to the Shangri-La of serverless. AWS is showing customers, this is the way you're supposed to do cloud. This is the way cloud should have been done from the beginning, but you came at it with the wrong model. I think we've hopefully gone through that pain now. And so maybe we can be looking forward to the next generation, what they're calling cloud native. So we've had those growing pains.
I want to argue that that's a step in the right direction. Lots of documentation, lots of things you can read on the AWS website, whether it's just simple blog posts or in the form of white papers. There's procedural documents that kind of show you a lot of this stuff. But it needs to go more than that. It needs to go beyond their certification programs. I think they need to have a consulting organization that they build that really gets good at handholding the enterprises and taking them, not just here's some documentation, here's some training, figure it out, but really does that work for them to make that customer sticky for the long term. I know that there's a zillion AWS partners out there, right? But those are going to be hit or miss what your success is with those folks. I used to work for not an AWS partner, but a partner for various vendors. And I can tell you, the way those things work is, again, hit or miss. It comes down to the ability of the engineer within those partner organizations and what they have experience with, what their training level is, how many other projects they're working on at the same time that they're working on yours to help you do that transformation. So my logic is, if AWS builds a consulting firm in-house that is going to really hold the hand of those enterprises and get them moved into those architectures, do that digital transformation, Drew, like you were talking about that roadmap that they laid out, what they end up with is a successful cloud migration where that application that they picked up and moved doesn't get repatriated, doesn't fail. It gets re-architected on the front end like it needs to, gets moved into the cloud. It's now an economically viable model. And because they're using magical AWS special services, then it's a sticky customer because moving them back out at that point really is hard, not just for data gravity reasons, but because of operational reasons and API reliance and things like that, that would just be like, move it. It's cost effective, so I don't have a reason to move it. It's fine. And now they're a customer for life and you've got that revenue. And then the next project that comes along, where's it going? It's going to AWS. It's not going multi-cloud. It's not hybrid cloud. It's going to be more and more and more AWS.
I'm curious because one of the things that I was reading when you sent me some of the links that you'd been looking at was that the total market for IT spend is far larger than the spend that's currently on AWS. You think AWS has now hit a $50 billion annual run rate, which is staggering. That's pretty amazing. But in the world of tech, it's actually not that big. It's about the same size as Cisco. So just, you know, let that sink in for a second. And then the other number I saw was, I believe, $3.6 trillion is the pool of IT money that's out there. So they're just a fraction of what's available. Mm-hmm. The pushback on AWS's growth recently has been their percentage of growth year over year continues to go down. Part of that is the law of large numbers, but part of that is that maybe their growth actually is decelerating. Do they need a new strategy to chomp off a bigger portion of that IT spend?
Ned and I are stopping the show for a moment to talk about today's sponsor, Onyx. Onyx is a cloud solutions provider, and they've got the credentials and awards that tell you they know what they're doing. Premier Google Cloud Partner, AWS Advanced Consulting Partner, 11-time Google Cloud Award winner, Tech Times number one for best cloud consulting services in 2020. And you're going, I don't care, Ethan. What does Onyx do? All right, fair enough. Onyx provides consulting services for cloud infrastructure, collaboration, devices, enterprise search, and geospatial technology. Let's drill into this. Think about one of the recurring themes of Day 2 Cloud. We have said in many episodes, there are companies that do lift and shift of workloads to the cloud, and they are sorry they did that. They pay dearly for that approach. They don't automate well. The companies don't leverage cloud native services. They don't consider application delivery design like they should. And why do they have all these problems? Cloud brings a lot of new technologies into an IT shop. It is hard to get it all right the first time, even with training, even though you're smart, even though you're a very capable engineer, even if someone gives you the luxury of time that most of you, frankly, are not given by your senior management. Well, okay, this is where the real value of Onyx comes in. Onyx is going to help you figure out what you really got. That's the discovery process. And it matters because you kind of think you know everything you've got in your infrastructure that's got to move to cloud, but you probably don't. Onyx is then, once the discovery is done, going to help you construct a plan. This is important. How do we move all the stuff we've got into the cloud? That plan is going to include a lot of the nitty-gritty detail about getting that data moved to the right place and stored in the right way, and then visualizing what's actually happening in the cloud and more. Even stuff that maybe you haven't considered before, like machine learning. They have experienced cloud-based machine learning nerds on staff at Onyx. All right, another Day 2 Cloud topic that comes up a lot, automation. Onyx can help you there too. They have specialists with deep expertise in cloud tool sets and automating that tedious stuff that you've been screwing up trying to do it all by hand. Been there, I'm right there with you. Well, Onyx can build you a data pipeline, integrate it with the existing tools and databases that you already have, and then bring new functionality to your current data solution. You're like, I don't know, that sounds complicated. It is. It maybe it is, but once they help you build all that fancy stuff, they're going to train you on the solution. So it's good, right? You're all good. Pretty cool stuff from Onyx. And for a limited time, Onyx is offering your organization a free 6-hour cloud data strategy workshop. That's a service they would normally sell for like $2,000 or more, but it's free for people who respond to this offer. And if you want more information, visit onyxnet.com/packetpushers. One more time, that's onyxnet.com/packetpushers. Let me spell Onyx so you don't get confused here. onyxnet.com/packetpushers for more information about their 6-hour cloud data strategy workshop. And now back to today's episode.
So this goes back to my general position that the next CEO doesn't really matter that much, because AWS is moving from what I think of as an innovation phase to a stewardship phase. So yes, there's still things a new leader needs to do, like try to get more enterprise partnerships, build out more better relations, maybe even develop an enterprise sales force to start bringing those customers and getting more of that IT money into AWS. That's not an innovation move, that's a stewardship move. The innovation, the operation model, the approach to technology, figuring out how to make a shared infrastructure, building what you can and buying what you need, and the company culture on how ferocious AWS is as a competitor, that's already in place. So the next CEO just needs to come in, maybe tweak the formula a little bit, but otherwise it's just cranking that wheel. So getting back to your point, Ned, about there's a ton of money for AWS out there to get, not to mention all the other cloud competitors. The pie is huge. So AWS has the strategy. Now it's just time to execute and start bringing those customers in. The pool of candidates you could find who could lead AWS to the next phase is much broader than the pool of people who could actually build AWS from the beginning.
But what is differentiating AWS at this point from the other clouds? Most of the other clouds, they've caught up in some way or another. Azure, lots of similar product offerings, at least for the core services, right? GCP, the same thing. Even Oracle Cloud, same thing. And then there's all these other clouds or cloud-like services that can give you a similar kind of result. So particularly if I'm early in my digital transformation journey, why do I necessarily go to AWS? Just because it's the most recognizable brand? Why wouldn't I look at Azure? Why isn't Azure necessarily going to be the one that is going to grow the most here coming up? Because a lot of enterprises have that deep Microsoft relationship. Wouldn't I start there? I think I would. And in fact, we know that many companies are doing that, at least for certain kinds of workloads.
Google Cloud made a really smart decision when they hired Thomas Kurian to head up their cloud division, because he had those deep enterprise roots. It's the reason that he was in charge of Oracle Cloud. And if Larry Ellison really had gotten out of his way and allowed him to build that business the way he wanted to, I think Oracle Cloud would have been much more successful now than it currently is. And we've seen the massive growth that Google Cloud has seen over just the short term that he's been in charge. And it makes me wonder, Microsoft has those deep enterprise relationships. Google historically has been terrible at building enterprise relationships, but now they have someone who knows how to do it. Where does AWS fall in that spectrum? Do they need someone in the leadership position whose sole focus is building those enterprise relationships?
So here's the thing. I think that sort of reinforces my point. Google turned to somebody who has enterprise and sales chops. They didn't necessarily turn to a technologist for the phase of their cloud growth. I think probably that's what we'll see AWS do for its move, because they, I think, do recognize they need to differentiate. And I guess I would say they are differentiating in that, to me, AWS is the velocity cloud. If you want new cutting edge features coming at you one after another, because you're at the cutting edge of digital transformation and you can't get it fast enough, AWS is the one for you. As I said, they're blazing the digital transformation trail. I think that's part of their culture, part of how Amazon itself does business. And that's how they differentiate from Azure, which is kind of your steady, comfortable friend, and you know what you're getting from them. And Google is just sort of all over the place. And in 6 months, it may not even be there, because everybody knows that Google kills products. So
I don't think Google's killing GCP, but you know, we've seen stranger things happen. But Drew, just to react to the point about if they hire an enterprise and salesperson, then you know that's good. AWS can build those relationships. But that's not a ham sandwich, is it?
Okay, so I was exaggerating about ham sandwich. It has to be a sentient ham sandwich, let's say.
Oh, that's terrifying. I don't need my ham sandwich talking to me. I think if I had to guess, and based off of my reading, where I would think AWS needs to invest their time, and we've already seen this a little bit, is in growing the hybrid and on-prem portions of their business. Yes, I mean, their cloud business, traditional public cloud, will continue to grow at a decent pace. But if they really want to have explosive growth, it's not going to be in those big regional data centers. I think it's going to be at the edge, in customers' data centers, and through sort of their local zones initiative. Those are all technology things, though. Do they need a technologist's overseeing that, or is that more of a salesy type thing and they can just let whatever group's in charge of that make sure the technology works?
It's both to me, because they have to displace VMware. It's just as simple as that for a lot of the use cases. They got to displace VMware, and that's going to be tough to get VMware out of there and replace it over time with outposts and local zones and, you know, and all the rest of it.
It's interesting because I've never heard someone say that so clearly. And it really just turned a light bulb on my brain. AWS needs to displace VMware. Because if you think about who's running in all those data centers, it's VMware. You have this weird parallel where VMware also runs on AWS, but that's probably, you know, we don't need to get into that. But yeah, if I think about it, who are the enterprises spending the big bucks on? They're spending it on VMware and then whatever hardware vendor du jour they want.
I mean, actually, I think I'm going to push back on that. I don't think AWS needs to replace VMware because AWS isn't trying to be in the data center. They are a cloud company and they are trying to draw their customers into the cloud. And the products that they've released so far are about that. They're just a stepping stone into the cloud. They don't need to live in the data center. And if you look at how VMware is developing its products, it's trying to develop to be a hybrid cloud or multi-cloud solution in that we're giving you a Kubernetes base layer where you can continue to run VM, but also develop your new applications. Net new applications are probably going to happen in the cloud. And that's what Amazon and the other cloud companies are betting on.
It's a use case problem, though, I think. The reason there's still hybrid cloud and so much interest in doing things at the edge are because there are specific use cases that are driving that, right at the core of it being latency, needing to be close, from a latency perspective, close to the work that is being done. Amazon, or AWS, I should say, with Outposts is making it easy for you to do AWS-like work very close by, so you can maintain your operational model that you've built up with AWS. So that's a use case there. Does that mean, you know, displace VMware? And I think that goes back to, well, if you want that one hand to shake, then maybe you start looking at your relationships and go, okay, I've been with VMware, it cost me this much. I've got all this other investment in Amazon and I've got this much. And it goes back to my point about, you know, your question, Ned, technologists or sales, who do they need to put in place to actually drive that adoption ahead? And I think they need both. On the sales side, you need to convince the C-suite that consolidating around AWS, whether it's in-house, you know, on-premises, or whether it's up in the public cloud is the right thing. And then the technologists need to believe in that as well. Probably starts in the developer room, I'm going to guess. But look, you can have a consistent operational model and have all of the functionality and performance that you're looking for and all this consistency. But it's got to come, I think, at both levels to make that happen, if the use cases are there.
I want to push on that a little bit in that I agree AWS needs to be at the edge because they can do, you know, have a solution for local processing. There's a use case for that. But VMware, I don't think, has a strong solution for the edge either. They are a data center company the way they're currently constructed. Yes, they're building out HCI platforms and stuff, but, you know, they're also fighting over it with Nutanix and HP and everybody else. So they're in the same boat as AWS and trying to go to the edge.
We're getting into semantics about what do we mean by data center versus the edge and all that stuff. And in my mind, edge is a really overblown term where I think of, if you're doing it in a house, call it edge, you know, close enough. That isn't what that means in every context, to be fair. Certainly isn't what that means for like a service provider where...
Yeah, that's not what I'm meaning by
edge. Yeah, so, but what do words mean? What do they mean? Oh, I don't know anymore.
That's a much longer podcast. Let's not get into that. I think what you brought up in terms of VMware, it bears additional thinking because what VMware has and what it's touted as its advantage for something like VMware and AWS is you get to keep your operational model.
Right.
Yep.
You're currently using VMware. Here's a way to use VMware in the cloud. Now, if you take that from the opposite end of the spectrum, you've got your cloud team developing these cool new applications and you've got an operations team that's helping them. And what is that team comfortable with? What are they using? They're using AWS. They're using infrastructure as code. They are comfortable with that tool set. And they look at what you have running in your data center and they hold their nose and go, ugh, oh, it's like a rotten sandwich. You don't want that. They're not interested in that. And AWS comes along and goes, hey, buddy, guess what? You know, when your hardware refresh comes around, why don't you buy some of these sweet outposts and then you'll have the exact same operational model in-house. We will manage it for you and you can pay for it monthly. How does that sound?
Depends on what that bill looks like every month, I guess. Yeah.
I mean, I also feel like we're getting too hung up on bills because it's not like VMware is cheap and it's not like VMware on AWS is saving you any money. You're spending twice as much for the whole caboodle. So enterprises are going to spend, yeah.
Right. I think it's more of a, if you can rationalize your operational model to focus on one or the other,
yeah,
that is a big advantage. That will be a cost savings because there's less training, there's less administrative overhead, possibly less headcount because you can do more with less.
VMware is doing what it can to keep people within its operational model. That's why it's making the things it's doing, like with Project Pacific and so on. It understands that developers are going to use what developers want to use. And right now that's moving toward cloud native stuff like Kubernetes and so on. And so they have to embrace it. But it also means slowly over time, they're eroding their base in favor of the AWS model. And that gives AWS that linchpin with an outpost to come in and start getting some of that enterprise business.
You still think, Drew, that it doesn't matter who Andy Jassy's replacement is? You know, in this context, it feels like we've articulated it's complicated for enterprises to make the decision about what the right way is to go. I mean, so I still take the tact here that it does matter because you need the right person to position AWS in all the right ways to encourage not just adoption, but then also stickiness. I can't tell if you are agreeing with that kind of viewpoint or still disagreeing, Drew.
No, I agree, but I guess I just feel like, you know, again, thinking of that innovator stewardship model, we're moving into a candidate pool that's a lot broader of people who will have the chops to do what AWS needs to do. The hard part was building that model in the first place and laying out the strategy. And you can, I mean, I feel like AWS has already anticipated all the things we're talking about, like, okay, we built cloud, now we have to get the enterprise, so we're building outposts and we're doing all this stuff to sort of suck them in. So the next person who comes in has the roadmap laid out for them. And so, yes, obviously you can't hire a total knucklehead who's just going to drive the business into the ground, but the candidate pool is so much broader. And are we going to remember who the second CEO of AWS was, you know, 10 years from now? Probably not, because they're just cranking the crank. They're just...
A ham sandwich with good hair can crank the crank. And
so you're thinking this is sort of the Steve Jobs versus Tim Cook sort of thing. Steve Jobs was an innovator building a company from the ground up. Tim Cook is a steward and he does have a direction, but a lot of the stuff that he promotes was already in flight when he took over.
It was baked in.
Yes. Yeah. He just needs to guide the ship successfully.
Exactly. And the company culture, I think, which is probably one of the keys here, is baked in as well, right? How AWS operates, what they expect of employees, how they do the business. That's baked in and that's been successful for them. And so all of that is set up for the next person to take over.
So I'll still argue against that, Drew, in this context, even though AWS is the market leader right now for public cloud, for sure. And nobody can dispute that, I don't think. Everyone is nipping at their heels now. And I'll put the John Chambers to Chuck Robbins at Cisco Systems transition, you know, out there. Who replaces John Chambers? You know, it mattered who. And Chuck's been fighting it for however long it's been now. I'm not sure how many years he's been in that, in his role. But, you know, Cisco had a major transformation to undergo, a little different than what we're talking about with AWS here, but there are parallels to be drawn. I feel that AWS, because they've got that target on their back, stands to lose bits of market share to a ton of different companies that can do what they do or can do some portion of what they do that might be good enough for a lot of enterprises, where enterprises aren't, they don't have a reason to go, oh, AWS, obviously, I'll start there. And if there's some reason I can't do it there, I guess I'll look outside. I don't think there's a reason to think that way anymore. So I think that the market dominance and, you know, dollars that they're cranking through, notwithstanding, there's so many other companies that I, as an enterprise, could go to do the same thing or a very similar thing that AWS does. Why wouldn't I necessarily, if there's reasons why I like some other option?
I mean, that's the same argument, though, you could make about Cisco. Like, why don't I buy Juniper? Why don't I buy Arista? Why don't I buy Extreme?
Which has been happening. Cisco is not as dominant as they were, say, 5 or certainly 10 years ago, if you look at market share in certain categories.
But that's because they're fighting over a smaller pie. The pie for cloud services is $1 trillion now, right? Because there's so much enterprise spend that could transition from on-prem to cloud. So the market, yes, AWS could, competitors could start to catch up, but AWS can still keep growing into that market.
Mm. Right, right. It's not like it's a winner-take-all game
at this point.
They're not They're not fighting for scraps here.
Exactly.
I think I would like to bring up, and this is probably the last point to bring up, a replacement CEO doesn't necessarily need to reinvent the culture or change the strategy or direction of the company, but they can easily ruin the strategy or the culture or the technology of a company by making bad decisions. I think we could take a look at Microsoft as a parallel. What happened when Steve Ballmer was in charge? And then what happened when Satya Nadella took over and course corrected for what Ballmer was doing? That was transformational. What we don't want, or at least what AWS doesn't want, I won't say we, I don't want to assume what our motivations are. What AWS doesn't want is a Ballmer type situation where somebody bombastic and big comes in, a knucklehead, if you will, and ruins the culture and what has catapulted AWS to the position they are now.
I think that's a great example, but I would say the counter to that is Ballmer came in still believing that the operating system was the value proposition and the market had moved on from that. Mm. I don't know that the market has moved on in a way that the next CEO is going to try to have to anticipate. We're still trying to digest what public cloud means. They don't have to transition away from that. The business model needs to be expanded as opposed to just transition. So I take what you mean, the next CEO could screw things up, but it's also that Steve Ballmer came into a position where he just wasn't suited to rethink where the market was going the way that Satya Nadella understood and then did a fantastic job transitioning to. AWS isn't in a transition space. They're in a drive adoption and grow it space. I would also say that the next CEO is going to be like 5 feet away from Andy Jassy. He's still there. It's not like John Chambers left, right? John Chambers left and let Chuck Robbins run it. Andy Jassy's still there. He's running Amazon. But the other thing to keep in mind is that AWS contributes nearly half of Amazon's profits, right? The net income that they take home. So AWS is key to that business. And Andy Jassy, I assume, is going to have at least one eye on the person who's taking over. So if that person does start to screw up, then, you know, we'll see a quick transition.
Okay. I like that. So final thoughts. Ethan, why don't you go first? Have you been convinced? Do you think a ham sandwich, a sentient ham sandwich, could take over at AWS and run the ship?
I think the AWS growth curve is not predictable at this point, and you need a particular person at the helm to drive it in a specific way, because the competitive landscape of public cloud is not anything like what it was when AWS started. It's a whole different world right now, and it's a careful, cautious place that AWS is in. I don't think it's simply crank the handle. I think that I do still think the person matters.
And Drew, your final thoughts?
I think there's a much broader pool of people who could step into AWS now and keep it successful, because all of the key components have been set up and it's a self-perpetuating motion machine and they just got to not screw up.
Like that. I think I tend to fall more towards Drew's side in the sense that they could, in theory, bring someone in. And as long as they don't screw up, AWS will be fine for the foreseeable future. However, they could bring in someone who would further accelerate that. So making a good choice could have a lot of value, you know, 10 years from now.
So just one more comment I'll make then, Drew, is I actually agree with both of you from a standpoint of there's a huge assumption in this place that I've been coming from in this show. The other folks, the competitors of AWS, have to execute well to take advantage of AWS not executing well. And that is far from a given.
Well, Drew, Ethan, thank you for jumping on and talking this through. It's given me a lot to chew on, and I'm sure it's given the listeners a lot to chew on. Coming up next on the show, we have a special sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with ThousandEyes. We're going to be talking about remote monitoring of VPNs and why it's a challenge that you actually probably care about right now, and how ThousandEyes is solving that for you. So that is coming up after this.
Welcome to the Tech Bytes portion of today's Day 2 Cloud episode. And joining us is Alex Cruz-Farmer from ThousandEyes. And we're going to get into the topic of VPN monitoring for a remote workforce, because we know y'all are out there with your remote workforces VPNing in from everywhere. That is life these days. Isn't that true, Alex?
Absolutely. It's been a tremendous migration for people to move to working from home. And I think it's been a huge struggle for even the most technical of us to really get up to speed with the types of ways that we've got to work differently with our teams, things like collaboration. And the last thing that we really want is, you know, are those connectivity problems that are not our fault, that are somewhere in between, you know, us and the application itself on that network.
So, okay, VPN connection specifically, let's dig into this. Me being one of these people that has had to deal with a lot of VPN inbounds over the course of years, and I've had VPN concentrators and firewalls and so on that I've had to manage, the performance question is always a huge one. I'm trying to connect to this, and so I'm on the VPN, and the application's just crawling. And I think a major point here is that you guys at ThousandEyes can actually help me solve that problem.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing is whenever you have an application crawling and you're connected to the VPN, the immediate thing you're going to do is point at the VPN, because that's always going to be that bone of contention. No one likes logging into a VPN. It's hard work. You've got to put 2FA in. You've got to put a password in. You've got to wait for it to connect. You lose local access to your network sometimes. It can be really, really painful. So immediately everybody will point at the VPN for all of the problems that happen when they're trying to reach an application. What actually we've seen is that when users are connecting to an application via a VPN, what can often happen is that the routing between them and the VPN gateway and the VPN concentrator could be congested. It could be a particular issue. There could be some weird, you know, routing issue that their upstream ISP has.
Now, you're talking about like where the VPN tunnel is going across the internet, let's say, somewhere in between that endpoint and the VPN concentrator. There's something happening there.
Yes. Yeah, exactly that. And I mean, imagine, you know, you work for an organization that's based out of the US and you're based in the UK and you're having to connect to a US based VPN, or you accidentally connect to a US based VPN. Sometimes it's hard to even see that. And it's hard to understand whether you've made a mistake with the connection that you've made out to that VPN gateway. And that could be the root of all your problems. And it's really hard for an IT engineer to identify where that problem really is.
Right. We're really dealing with two different sets of traffic. We're dealing with the traffic that's traversing that tunnel, and then we're dealing with the traffic of however that tunnel's being constructed across the wider internet. And there's so many different areas where that ball could get dropped. And I feel like, at least in my experience with VPNs, I don't have any visibility into that underlay where the tunnel is going. All I have is visibility into my connection back to that concentrator, and then whatever is happening with that tunnel. So how would you go about constructing that view of what's happening in the underlay that's supporting the tunnel?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when you're looking at the path from a user that's connected to a VPN, you can never really see the underlay. It's completely hidden. So what we do at ThousandEyes is we engineer a way that we can then create a path and give you visibility into the path to the VPN gateway. And then what we do is then we merge together the path from the VPN gateway then to the applications. You've got that full end-to-end view. So if the issue is potentially, you know, a couple of hops away on your upstream provider from your broadband, then we'll be able to identify it. But if there is actually a problem behind the VPN, we will also be able to help you identify that too, because we'll have full visibility of that overlay.
Oh, that is, you said behind the VPN, as in I've actually made it to the other side of the tunnel, out the firewall, the concentrator, and there's something even beyond that that's my problem?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, if you think that the VPN concentrator could be congested because there are lots of people connecting to it at the same time, that could be where that bottleneck is. And because we can give you the underlay, we can rule out your connectivity as being the problem and then move that visibility and focus onto the VPN concentrator.
I think we saw a lot of that issue when the pandemic first started and everybody started hitting the concentrator. And I know, like, whenever I sized a concentrator for a deployment, the assumption was you'd only have a small percentage of your workforce, even your mobile workforce, connecting at any given time, because they were going to connect in, get the thing they needed, and get back out. It wasn't going to be connected all day for 8 hours and in 90% of your workforce. So that's the problem that we had to solve for a year ago. What sort of problems are cropping up now beyond just oversubscribed appliances?
So it's interesting. Today, what we're seeing is a lot more organizations are wanting to move a lot of their VPN concentrators away from hardware-based solutions into the cloud. Look at things like SD-WAN and WAN transformation projects, because a lot of organizations don't see this remote workforce, you know, coming all back to the office. I think, you know, as we're moving forward, a lot of us are going to spend multiple days at home. You know, I'm hopefully going to be spending more days at home, which is great because I have a 7-month-old daughter that I want to spend more time with. So for me, you know, I know that I'll be spending a few more days at home than I would be, you know, pre-pandemic, where I was 5 days in the office.
So the point you're making here is that the model of VPN is changing. That is, it's not old school. We've been doing this right into the firewalls and the concentrators and stuff. And everybody comes into headquarters and we apply our policy and we do things. But now, because our resources are distributed everywhere, it's up in the cloud, it's wherever it is. Right. We'll build an SD-WAN fabric that includes those original headquarters locations, perhaps, but also has remote office locations and also has our cloud presences all tied into that fabric. So when we're doing VPN, we're VPNing into perhaps a third-party service, perhaps into a concentrator that's up in the cloud. There's a variety of ways that we could do it now to put our VPN users closer to the resource they're trying to consume, which makes monitoring and troubleshooting all that more complicated.
Yeah. I mean, if you consider that, you know, we've got people within ThousandEyes who are based out of, you know, Portugal. We've got them in the US. We've got them in the UK. We've got teams out in APAC. You know, we've got to support all of these different disparate locations. So not having that visibility into knowing where they're connecting to, why they're connecting to a specific VPN gateway, what the latency is there potential congestion there, all of these different problems. It's really, really challenging to try and identify these without that in-depth visibility that you get from ThousandEyes.
So let's get into the magic of how ThousandEyes is doing what it's doing here in this use case. I'm a former ThousandEyes customer, Alex, going back a few years. And the model that I remember was there was an agent that would sit in a virtual machine and that I could run tests against some resource that was out there, or perhaps against a remote ThousandEyes agent. And that gave me all kinds of insights into, okay, what's going on in the WAN, what's going on in my MPLS cloud, what's going on across the internet, and I could see hop by hop where the problems were. Now, you're telling me I'm getting the same kind of a thing with this VPN monitoring use case, but how are the tests running? Where is it? Is there something sitting on the endpoint where that user's VPN client is running?
Yeah, great question, Ethan. I mean, one of the things that ThousandEyes is known for is the enterprise agent and our cloud agents. What we actually also have is something called our endpoint agent, which is something that sits on the user's device. So this is something that can be extremely nimble, extremely mobile. You know, we even ran some testing recently and found that our agent runs less, uses less CPU and less RAM than Notepad does. So, you know, it's a very, very lightweight agent that can sit there behind the scenes. And it really, really gives that, you know, edge to our customers to get the monitoring going. So, you know, looking at the endpoint agent itself, we can do a lot of the same things that the enterprise agent does. We can run scheduled testing. So we can have 10 scheduled tests, which allow you to, you know, probe out to multiple different applications. We have our browser extension, which is added to Chrome, Internet Explorer 11 and Edge. And the browser extension essentially pulls metadata in and kind of gives you that Chrome waterfall style feel in the ThousandEyes dashboard to help you identify where there are problematic documents that may be loading on a particular web application.
So wait a minute, you just said ThousandEyes dashboard. Is that mm-hmm. a centralized thing that I, as an IT staff person, am looking at, or is that something that the end user might look at?
So the ThousandEyes dashboard is what the IT team would look at. So right. This is a centralized view where it will consolidate all of the endpoint data that we're collecting for all of your users into one central place. And you can use that and build a 30,000 foot view to understand the whole landscape of all of your users, but then also then drill down to really, really specific windows, you know, down to a 5-minute window, look at the performance and see how things are looking for that user.
Does that mean if I have some high touch customers within my organization, people that are, you know, really critical and I want to make sure that their VPN performance is absolutely excellent, I could zoom in on them specifically?
Absolutely. So the way that our agent will work is if you go ahead and you can deploy the agent silently through your SCCM or some kind of global deployment, or you could just download it from our website and install it on your device. Once you've got it installed, we automatically will detect that you're running a Cisco AnyConnect VPN, and we also detect Palo Alto, Global Protect, Pulse Secure, and also Zscaler Internet Access. And what we can do from that is that when scheduled tests are set up, or if you're using just the browser extension, we'll start collecting all that path data and giving you that network visibility straight away.
Alex, where were you 10 years ago when I needed you?
Yeah, it's a great question.
Horror stories about previous CEOs and such that I've had to support with their VPN. And this would have been amazing at the time. It sounds pretty cool now. And I just want to drill into a point that you mentioned multiple different VPN vendors. So this is not a VPN vendor specific solution. That you're supporting multiple vendors with this solution, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, while ThousandEyes did get acquired by Cisco, and Cisco was one of the first VPN providers that we did support, and that was way before the acquisition, it was really, really important for us to also support other VPNs as well. There are lots of organizations out there who are looking at doing WAN transformations, you know, moving from, say, Palo Alto over to Cisco AnyConnect, or potentially, you know, they're looking at comparing two different VPN vendors or cloud VPN providers together. So we need to give that kind of agnostic approach to it. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to get that true visibility.
So that supporting those VPN clients directly means what exactly? You're hooking into some information that's peculiar and specific to those VPNs and being able to trickle that up into the ThousandEyes dashboard?
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, we essentially look to see if you're connected to a VPN or not. And then if we know you're connected to a VPN, what we can then do is essentially take that and plumb that into the way that we present the path trace data to you. So that's how we know and can give you that underlay and overlay data. If you're not connected to a VPN or using Split Tunnel, for example, then we don't put any VPN overlay in there because there isn't any VPN that you'll be traversing at that point.
Right. No, path trace data, you just said the magic words there, because when we were prepping for the show and you showed us exactly what you can see, you can visualize from the endpoint, that person running the VPN client, all the way to wherever their VPN tunnel terminates on the other end, and all the underlay hops in between, including, Alex, and I think this is really cool, like they're on Wi-Fi at home and it's terrible. You can actually see that.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing. You know, if you think that a lot of the problems that we're having, when you're at home is, you know, you may have like a son or a daughter who's like playing their Xbox in the next door and downloading stuff and saturating the Wi-Fi. Or it could be just simply that you've connected to the wrong Wi-Fi access point. There are some very, very basic things that IT are not able to see when you're at home without something like ThousandEyes on your device. Because this is a type of telemetry that just isn't usually available. So with ThousandEyes in there, we'll be able to pull things like your signal quality, and we can make sure we're providing that SSID. So we know, or the IT team knows that you're connected to the right access point. And then we can kind of trace that back and make sure that things like your local gateway has not got packet loss or not got high latency. And there's a whole load of step-by-step things that you can do all the way from that device through your Wi-Fi, through your local gateway, across the network, all the way out to the application.
Great stuff, Alex. If people want to know more about this, they want to dig into the solution, maybe they want to give it a trial, where would they go?
Yeah, I mean, head to ThousandEyes.com. We provide a free trial for 14 days, and you can try out our cloud agent, enterprise agent, and you can also obviously get our endpoint agent as well, and try it out for 14 days. And our support team is stellar, and they'll be more than happy to help you along the way if you get stuck.
Alex, thank you very much for being on our Tech Bytes portion of Day 2 Cloud today. That was Alex Cruz Farmer chatting with us about VPN remote monitoring. And that brings us to the end, Ned. It's very sad. That brings us to the end of our Day 2 Cloud today. So virtual high fives to you for listening. You're pretty awesome out there. It's still a pandemic going on. We know. We're all sick of it. We know. But you are still awesome. We just want you to know that's a big deal. If you'd like to reach out to Ned and I about a topic you want us to cover, by all means, Twitter at Day 2 Cloud Show, or go to the form on Ned's very fancy website, nedinthecloud.com. Anything you got that's cloud related or career related, like we did a show on IT consulting recently that we got some good feedback on. A lot of you really liked that show. Hey, we'll talk about that career stuff too, if that's what you want. Send in your questions and we'll find some guests and have a show. We will do that. And again, those virtual high fives to you, just remind yourself how awesome you are, because you really are. Last but not least, remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.